listener production.
Elise Lunan is a writer, editor, podcast host, and former chief content officer at Goop. Elise is a seeker and a synthesizer, braiding together wisdom traditions, cultural history, and a deep knowledge of healing modalities to unlock new ways to contextualize who we are and why we're here. Elise and my meeting is one of many synchronicities. A mutual friend made the connection for us, but we have both admired each other's work from afar. In the conversation that follows, we discuss how we approach life, faith, the universe, and we go through some of the seven deadly sins that are discussed in Elise's new book, On Our Best Behaviour.
What are they? Sloth, envy, pride, gluttony, greed, lust, anger. And they come together as this checklist of what it is to be a good woman in a pretty stunning and very stark way. And they were not actually in the Bible.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Through my years of studying and researching the connection between human behaviour, personal growth, and transformation, I have discovered the keys to unlocking greatness within others. In this podcast, I share stories and experiences from my own teachings, along with conversations with inspiring guests to help you learn the simple tips, habits, practices, and strategies to cultivate an extraordinary existence. Elise Lunan is the author of the New York Times best-selling book On Our Best Behaviour. This conversation revolves around a topic dear to me, the challenging path towards authenticity and self-actualization, expanding our perspective on life, allowing for continual growth, learning, and transformation. Sharing space with Elise was an absolute pleasure. My hope is that this conversation inspires you to take control of your life and find the beauty that exists in yourself and the world around you. Elise, I feel like there's so many synchronicities that have brought us together today, so many breadcrumbs. And it was interesting because when I'm reading your new book, On Our Best Behaviour, I'm like flicking through the pages thinking, this woman, it's like we are very different but mirror each other in so many different aspects, which is so beautiful. So you were telling a tale that I felt was like very close to my heart as well, but your life is actually different but not dissimilar. And, you know, a lot of people do know you from your previous role as the chief content officer for Goop, but, you know, you've done so much obviously since you've left there. Where did your interest in personal development work come from?
I would say, and I'm probably not dissimilar from so many people, it really didn't start until my early 30s. I think I had been breathless for the first quarter of my life in pursuit of safety and security and approval and control and all those sort of specters that chase us, right? Until I realized I am never going to get on top of these fears. I just have to learn how to manage myself. I cannot control the world. I cannot engineer certainty. Everything is not going to go as planned. All I can do here is work on my own inner chemistry and the way that I'm responding to the world. And so that's really when I entered therapy and started reading nonfiction. I had never really read nonfiction and started exploring my inner world. Although I'll also say, and it's interesting what you open with, how we're all in some ways Rorschach tests for each other. And I'm sure you and I in particular, based on how we lead our lives, are very similar in our preference for people and thinkers. But I've always been interested in understanding myself better, but also primarily so that I can understand a larger story or a larger cultural container or a bigger story in general of what are we all doing here and what is the point of this racket called life. So it's been both for me. understanding myself, but also trying to stay connected, not getting mired in my own, not that interesting story, but using myself as a way to understand a bigger context.
A lot of your work reflects the spiritual aspects of life, kind of very similar to mine. And I wonder, where did that come from? Were you brought up in an environment like that? How have you nurtured that over the years?
That's a wonderful question. And it's funny because my book is tangentially about religion, but more religion is culture, but it definitely has a wider, it's a wider spiritual closet. So I grew up in Montana, which is a rural state in the US, and I grew up very much in nature with horses, and my parents were both transplants there. My father is a Jewish doctor who grew up in South Africa and ended up in America after his residency and wanted to have horses and be a cowboy. And my mom is from Iowa, which is the middle of the country. And she was the oldest of a large Catholic family. And she is, and she would probably call herself a recovering Catholic. She had a traumatic experience with religion. And so I grew up going to services, Jewish services, so that we could have some attachment to a culture. But it was in a Methodist church, this very small Jewish community in Montana. And I never had a bat mitzvah. I essentially grew up outside, mostly outside of religion. And what's been interesting to me is that I didn't really allow myself to have bigger spiritual questions until the last, again, like the last decade or so, even though I was very intimately aware of several things as a child and as a young adult, namely that there was some, I could feel the presence of some sort of energy throughout my life. I never felt alone, even though I spent so much of my childhood in nature, quote unquote, alone. I always felt the presence of some thing, some force. I always felt like I could speak to animals. I had horses. I felt like we could communicate. And I felt very much like this is not my first rodeo and I cannot believe I'm here again. As a child, I was pissed. Like I had this sensation quite frequently of, I cannot believe I'm doing this again.
Wow.
I know. And this impatience of like, oh, I don't want to be a child anymore. I've done this. Can we just like get to the work? So I think only when I was older and started reading really people like Carl Jung that I started to understand or put myself in a deeper conversation with the universe or force or whatever we want to call it. I'm probably one of those people that who annoys some where I am unaffiliated and I read widely and I typically love wisdom traditions, Sufism, mystical Judaism, Kabbalah, some of the really profound Christian thinkers, et cetera. Like that's typically where I go and where I feel like I'm finding a container that makes sense to me that includes everything, including science and materialism, and everything belongs, I think, in some of these systems that are essentially saying the same thing.
I totally agree. Like I was brought up Jewish and studied the Kabbalah with a rabbi for many years when I was young. But then, you know, I love A Course in Miracles and understanding everything to do with Jesus and, you know, Rumi, the Sufi poets are just divine and beautiful. And Buddhism, you know, learning about that is just fills my cup so much. I think it is so important to not close the doors to all of these religions and take the best bits from them.
Yes.
I'm not a religious person, but I love the beauty in a lot of these traditions and I love the wisdom that they keep. And I think that if we can always have an open mind to that stuff, it's like you and I interviewing people on our podcast. I don't just have one sort of person. I like interviewing a whole range because there's just something different in everyone's story.
Yes. And the way that I think or distinguish it too. And Alan Watts has this amazing quote about this distinction is that I would call myself a person of faith. I don't have a lot of beliefs. I don't know that I actually, there's nothing that I'm holding on to as a superstructure where I'm staking my beliefs. I have faith. He talks about how faith lets go while belief clings. And I think, unfortunately, so many religions have these, there are these foundational beliefs and we're loath to question them or push against them or explore them. But these religions, and this is why I love Judaism, it's an evolving, growing tradition, right? Where rabbis are constantly arguing about the Torah and the Talmud. And so I like this idea of being a person of faith, open to the unknown, recognizing that some things happen, maybe feel like they're happening to us, but perhaps are happening for us. And that the best thing, Father Richard Rohr, who I love, says, the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certitude. And I love that. I think about that a lot. So I try to stay out of certitude in that place of, I don't know. I do not know what's unfolding, but I really think it's interesting.
Before we got on, we talked about David White, who's a beautiful poet that I've interviewed. And I remember he was saying like a John O'Donohue quote. He was a good friend of his. And he said something about like when we talked about spirituality, he said, spirituality is not walking over water always, but it's knowing that there's something rather than nothing.
Yes.
I always think about that because I think it's just knowing that just makes this whole journey feel so much more meaningful.
Yes. It's living. You know, you mentioned Jesus. I love Jesus, who he was a Rabboni and his apostles were Jews. And now there's a new religion and that's amazing. But what he was illustrating was highly symbolic. And the crucifixion was this highly symbolic, not, I think, oh, he died for our sins so that we may be saved. But this is what we do as humans. We die and we're resurrected over and over and over again. We die to ideas. We die to relationships. We die to careers. And this is the process. This is the cycle of life. And this is, if you let it, if you allow it, if you allow that death and resurrection, this is your chance to get bigger and wiser and more expansive.
You know, before we started this interview, someone was telling me about, yeah, I reckon you would know this, the story in the Greek mythology about, it's to do with Narcissism and Echo.
Yeah.
And have you heard it? Yeah. And I was reading up on it and the whole idea about how the narcissist fell in love with his reflection in the water and then he met Echo and Echo was fell immediately in love with him but just echoed everything that he said and how that story played out. And I think to myself, even just like understanding that and then understanding narcissists in life and the idea of sometimes if you're with a narcissist and what sort of personality traits that can bring out of you, like going back to Greek mythology is so unbelievably interesting.
Yes. No, I love that story. And one of the, he's a psychologist who wrote this book that's been retitled. His name's Craig Malkin. Hopefully this is available in Australia, but it's called something like Rethinking Narcissism or Healthy Narcissism. And he tells that story about Narcissus and Echo and how Echo loses, what happens to Echo is she loses her voice. And he writes about, too, the scale of narcissistic traits. And obviously, we're also, I think women in particular are terrified of being perceived as narcissistic. And so we tend more towards echoism. So they're actually on a scientific scale where it tends towards narcissism on one extreme and echoism, where you lose yourself, literally,
yes.
Like you, there's no self, it's dissolved. And you are echoing what's presented to you. And his point is like, it's the health is in the middle. Everyone needs healthy narcissism, a healthy sense of self, an assertion of that self. And so our instinct, though, is to sort of be so extreme always, mm. right? To find the binary and take that oppositional stance. So
yes.
I'm so scared of being perceived as narcissistic, I'm going to become echo.
Fascinating story. So fascinating. I wonder, how did you find yourself at Goop? You've written books for years and then, you know, I see you on the Goop Netflix show and hosting the podcast many years ago. How did that come about?
So I was a magazine editor for a decade in New York at Condé Nast. And I worked first at this magazine that doesn't exist anymore called Lucky, which was about personal style, fashion, and shopping. And it's funny, I was an English and fine arts major. I went to Yale and I ended up at Condé Nast. I desperately just wanted to work with words. And growing up in Montana, magazines were, you know, like Wizard of Oz. It was such a mesmerizing world to me and I loved it and I desperately wanted to be part of it. And so I got a job. It was very hard. It was 2002. The economy was in terrible shape. I was couch surfing trying to find a job and I got this freelance job at Lucky and was like, I can't work in a magazine about shopping. You know, I went to Yale and it was the best job I ever had. I loved that job because it taught me, you know, try writing about 20 handbags and explaining the benefits of each one in a revelatory, fun, interesting way without repeating any words. Like, it was so hard, so much harder in so many ways than writing, you know, long think pieces. And everyone I interviewed with in the building at Vogue and Vanity Fair and the New Yorker was like, you should stay where you are. You're getting much better experience. So I had this incredible career doing service journalism, which is what we would sort of call it at Lucky, with incredibly smart people. And then I went to Condé Nast Traveler and then I moved to Los Angeles to work for this big internet company because I didn't know anything about the internet. And I knew at that point, Condé Nast was in a different building in Manhattan. There was no integration. And it was very clear to me, this is 2010, that if I wanted to be involved with words, I would not have a career if I didn't learn the internet. So I moved to LA, worked for this company, learned so much. I was the only creative or one of, you know, a couple of creatives on my team with a sea of digital product people and UX designers. And then I really miss being at a brand. And I was ghostwriting a book for Tracy Anderson, who's this trainer.
Yeah.
And at that time, Gwyneth owned part of her company or significant part. And so I was working with the team that was supporting both. And then when Gwyneth moved to Los Angeles from London, I went in to talk to her about Goop, which at that time was just a newsletter. But it had an incredibly very high engagement. And it was, the site was essentially just the newsletter dropped onto the site with a few products that were for sale. But I hadn't been tracking the company closely. I'd never worked my dad's a doctor and my mom's a nurse. So I grew up in the hospital typing my dad's transcription. Like I grew up in medicine, but I'd never worked in beauty or at Self Magazine or anything like that. But I was aware of Goop. I wasn't a big reader of it, but I knew it was a cultural phenomenon. And then sort of looking at what was happening, I was like, wow, there's so much untapped potential here because this is a highly engaged audience. And people are so curious about this world. And I ended up joining, I think at the end, I sort of unofficially started and then officially started in 2013, 2014. And it was so fun. It was a really fun job because originally it was content and that's my jam. And we, you know, I led the content team, which was newsletter, website. And then we had a book imprint. We did a magazine with Condé Nast. We did the podcast, which I ended up co-hosting. And we did this show with Netflix. So it was fun, you know, just doing stuff in people were really interested in collaborating with us, and we were certainly lobbing conversation grenades into the culture in a way that was fascinating. And so, yeah, it was in some ways being the right person in the right place at the right time for that opportunity. It was just one of those interesting moments where I knew a lot about what, if that makes sense. Like,
yes.
I didn't seek it out. It sort of just happened, and it felt like, oh, well, this is a door I need to walk through. There's something important for me to learn here.
And then what made you want to kind of close that door?
Well, I'm a content person ultimately, and Goop is a business, you know, it's a venture backed business, and the hope or the business intention of it was to have a certain size media business, but to primarily be products. And I had a very strong team, and I'm a strong presence, and I am always going to fight for content. And that's not what the business needed ultimately. And that's not, you know, it was one of those things where, and I'm sure creatives who are listening to this can relate, where you can be an incredible asset when there needs to be growth and new opportunities. And you can also be a liability when you're like, what's next? You know? Mm. And that's more my inclination, is to explore, just keep cracking open new conversations. And that's not always what a business needs. And that's what I needed, though. And ultimately, hosting the podcast was so fun. This is my favorite format. And interviewing people and talking to cultural luminaries and exploring their minds, like, that's really all I want to do. I don't really want to, you know, sell product, and I want to write books. And so it was time, ultimately.
I wonder, you know, I did a big leap when I went from producing Australia's biggest podcast, which is a comedy podcast with two very well-known Australians, to just go on my own and do the podcast I'm doing now. And there was a part of me that knew that it was the right thing to do, but also I was shit scared, thinking like, wow, I'm giving up a job that hundreds of thousands of people will be lining up for. And it's not like when you give it up, you go, hey, I made a mistake, come back. Did you think that? And how did you then still, you know, move forward kind of into the unknown, I suppose?
Yeah. Well, I tell a story in the book about going to this Eagle release. I was on a spiritual retreat, and as part of it, we had paid for the rehabilitation of many birds who had been injured, you know, hit by cars, et cetera, yes. And then were rehabilitated so they could be released. And we went to the top of this mountain in Utah, and we released owls, we released hawks, and then there was an eagle named Sauti. And it was such a beautiful metaphor for exactly what you're talking about. Mm. So Sauti had been, I think, in rehabilitation for a year, where her flight was obviously limited until she could regain strength. And we did a ceremony. There was a medicine man who did a blessing. He tied feathers to her hair, or to her tail. It was so beautiful. She was hooded. And then her caregiver, you know, had the leather glove and went to get her out of the cage to liberate her. And she was so scared. And she was clenching just like full talon grip on this metal cage. And they had to pry her talons off one by one. And then, you know, get her on this caregiver's arm, who was, you know, devastated, crying, just so upset about saying goodbye to this beautiful bird. And then so they had her up, they took off her hood, and then on the count of three, they throw them into the air to give them a little bit of extra momentum. And she just didn't want to leave. Mm. And so they throw her, and she starts flying, and she is looping around us really low again and again. And then finally she takes off and there's this medial rainbow, a rainbow circle. It was so, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It was amazing. And she takes off. She sort of circled again high and then she's gone. And it was such an incredible metaphor, Sarah, for how so many of us cling to our cages and stay small and stay with what's known because we're scared. And then you get outside of the cage and you are stunned by what's possible, but it is so hard. It is so hard to let go of the certainty of the cage and the promise of meals and all of it. Mm. But there was no way she was going to get back into the cage. And I don't know how you feel. You know, it was scary, certainly scary.
So scary.
But I've also ghostwritten books throughout my life. I've never really ever allowed myself to rely on a single job for my security. And so I know how to hustle. So it's sort of like I stabilized myself and until I could really understand what this would be like.
Totally.
And that made the process much calmer for me because I'm not the sort of, I don't take big risks. I have two kids. I'm a primary breadwinner. But now I would never go back. I would never take a full-time job. I'll never, I mean, who knows, but I'm not planning on operating in a business that's not my own creative pursuits again, if I can help it.
I agree with you. There's not one bit of me that looks back and goes, oh, I regret that or anything. I look upon that time so fondly, but my chart forward was the right one. But I set myself up like you did before. I didn't just like leap out of that cage. Like I had my ducks in a row. I didn't know if they'd work out, but they did.
Yeah.
But I made sure I wasn't just like jumping out into nothingness.
No. And I think it's completely acceptable to be sort of like a spiritually minded, I'll find support, this will happen, and to be exceptionally practical. And so, yes. And for any sort of freelance minded people, maybe a third of things actually comes to fruition. So it's, you have to plant a lot of seeds.
Yes.
And then track. You know, for me, I write about this in the chapter on greed, but for me too, I've never been someone who has, I've been too terrified to budget just out of my own shame around spending and money. And, you know, I write about that a bit, but as I was entering this phase and freaking out about how I wouldn't be able to, you know, I was like, I just don't think I'll be able to pay the bills. I don't know that I'll have enough, that I'll have needs met. And this woman, Krissa, who's a spiritual teacher I work with, she was like, well, what do you need? And what are your needs? What are your wants? How much money do you need to make? Which seems so elementary, but I honestly, I couldn't answer it. Yeah. And she was like, this is what happens all the time. People come to me and they're just in this energy of not enough, but write it down. And the divine is very good at meeting needs. Not always so good at meeting wants, but very good at meeting true needs. Mm. So can you write it down and arrive at a number? And I did that. I made an Excel document. I started tracking incoming and just wrote everything down in a very simple way. My friend Erica, who's a CFO, makes fun of me as being the only person who writes words in Excel.
I do too.
Right? It's the only way to use Excel. Yeah. She's like, this is for formulas and not paragraphs. But I concretized it. I wrote it down. I made it real. And then I realized like, oh, I can do this. This is, and I also, it was such an amazing process because the needs are easy, I think, to write down. They're quite clear, right? Mortgage, food, et cetera. And then the wants, as I actually ran my wants through my body, I was like, I want to take my kids skiing. I want to take my kids on a summer vacation. I just didn't have that. I mean, no shame to people who have a lot of wants, but I actually couldn't really come up with that many. And that was also reassuring because I think so many of us feel like there's endless wanting of material things.
Yes.
I really just want books and some trips every once in a while.
It's so true.
Therapy.
That is very
some
important.
Some acupuncture.
Yeah.
Maybe a need. Yeah.
In your book on our best behavior, you start off in late 2019, you kind of had a dark night of the soul where you found yourself not being able to breathe properly. Do you know, this is the most incredible thing. Well, it's not incredible, but something similar. I found myself in that situation about just over a decade ago, and I did not know what was happening to me. And I literally couldn't breathe properly for 3 months.
Yes.
And I didn't realize, because I'd never had anxiety before then, and I didn't realize that that's what it was, but it was very scary and, you know, I got myself back. But I'd love to hear about your experience.
Has it happened to you since?
No, not really.
Not to that.
It's interesting. This is how hormones play such a part in the way that females are made up and men, that I can tell if I'm getting my period because sometimes my breathing for that week becomes a bit funny, but not to the extent that it was that time.
Yeah.
And that's how I go, oh, it's coming.
Yeah. So my dad is a pulmonologist, which is interesting. And my mom is a chronic hyperventilator, as is my aunt. And so I had never done it. I didn't really have any experience of it until I was in my 20s when I ended up going to the emergency room because I thought I was going to die because it generates panic. So the basic idea, and this is, I'm glad we're talking about this because every time I talk about it, so many women say, oh my God, that's me. I didn't know what it was called. In fact, I was interviewing Ambassador Samantha Powers and she writes about this in her book and she calls it lungers. Wow. And I'm like, Samantha Powers doesn't know that this is chronic hyperventilation. Nobody knows what they don't, it's just this sort of phantom.
Yeah. I thought it's just anxiety.
Yeah. And it's one of those, it's a classic mix up between brain and body where your lungs have plenty of oxygen, but the perception in your brain is like, instead of having a dollar worth of oxygen, you only have 95 cents. And so you start over breathing to compensate and your lungs get too full and then you cannot take a deep breath.
Yeah. The whole time I was like, I can't get the full breath. It was mentally agonizing.
It's awful. And it creates panic. And if you don't know what's happening, you end up in the hospital where they give you a Xanax prescription and tell you it's all in your head. But it's very scary and debilitating because the only way that you can then take a deep breath is if you yawn.
Yes.
And it doesn't always work, but you end up becoming consumed by this, like, am I going to be able to take a deep breath or not? It's awful. And I had more or less been able to get my hands around it through making sure I didn't get too sleep deprived, making sure I didn't overdo it with caffeine. But in this particular, where I opened the book, I'd been doing it like you for months. And I was talking about it with my therapist because with all of these conditions where it's like, well, it's just you're just malfunctioning and it's your anxiety and there's nothing to be done. I was like, I have to figure this out. I can't live like this where you can hear it in my breathing on the podcast. I'm yawning through meetings. I look narcoleptic, but I'm inside consumed with anxiety, right? We're talking about it. And essentially where I landed is that I've spent my whole life trying to, again, engineer certainty, prove that I'm good enough, thin enough, smart enough, all the enoughs, right? A good enough mother, a good enough employee, and a good enough manager, and on and on and on. And that it's a specter. This is chasing me, and that I'm never going to outrun it. And I have to find a way to attend to my own existential anxiety. I have to attend to these feelings of not feeling like enough. And I'd been doing enough therapy that I could recognize in that moment several things. One, I was never going to source this to my family. It wasn't my parents. I didn't grow up with, you know, it wasn't childhood trauma. This was cultural to me. This was a bigger entity. And I also knew from talking to people like Samantha Power or other sort of high-powered women, that these voices telling us that we're not enough are insidious and everywhere. Everyone has them. And we all think that there are. We all think that there are individual voice telling us that we suck, but that these are big cultural stories. These are old toxic myths that women have been carrying around for centuries. And so that was the genesis for the book of wanting to understand where this came from. Where did this idea that I'm not good enough come from? Mm.
And then you bring in the seven deadly sins, which, you know, and you mentioned this in the book, I hadn't thought about since the movie Seven. God, that was a good movie. Wasn't Gwyneth Paltrow in that?
Yes. Her head's in the box.
Yeah.
I know.
I was like, oh, and who was that? Kevin Spacey. Oh, he was pretty incredible in that as well. Reading your book, I was like, oh my goodness, this is all falling together exactly how I would never have put it together like this, but it's just perfect for what you're trying to explain.
It's messed up, right?
It's so messed up. And I want to talk about these sins because I think they're particularly interesting. And I know this is in no particular order, but I want to start off with this idea of envy and females especially, and how a lot of the time, you know, envy is a good sign because it makes us realize what we kind of want for ourselves, but it also can be quite toxic, and why a lot of women sometimes bring other women down, especially considering in the culture we are today with feminism and trying to empower women. I feel that sometimes that doesn't always happen.
Yes. And envy is where I started. So I'm glad you started there too. And for anyone who's listening, it's like, yeah, what are they? Sloth, envy, pride, gluttony, greed, lust, anger. And they come together as this checklist of what it is to be a good woman in a pretty stunning and very stark way. And they were not actually in the Bible. That's the other.
Wow.
they didn't become the cardinal vices until 590 AD when Pope Gregory assigned them all to Mary Magdalene. Mm. And that's the same time that he turned Mary Magdalene into a penitent prostitute. So that's sort of where they start in our culture, our cultural imagination. And then we pass these ideas on to each other. So envy is where I started, in part because of a conversation I had with Lori Gottlieb, who's a psychotherapist who wrote this book called, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Great
She's
book.
She's been on this. Yeah, great book.
Okay. Of course she's been on. So
she's been on the podcast.
So Lori, it's a very small moment in her book, but she says that she tells her clients to pay attention to their envy because it shows them what they want. And I just couldn't get this out of my mind for two reasons, Sarah. One, I had this immediate visceral reaction to the word envy and immediately distanced myself from it. I don't feel it. It's gross. I would never, I'm not envious of any other woman. Ew, no. Which of course, as you start to do more work on yourself, you recognize like, oh, okay. It's sweet that that's your response, but clearly there's good information there. And then the second, this idea that envy shows us what we want. And I realized that didn't know what I wanted. Mm. I had never articulated it. I've never allowed myself to dream about it. And I'm not alone because as women, we are conditioned to subjugate our wants to other people's needs. For so few of us do we have any conscious awareness or agreement of this is what I want and I'm going to go and get it. And so what happens in this cycle of envy is, and you mentioned this as well, it's I think the source or the locus of so much of women on women hate is our instinct when we see a woman who is inspiring our envy. We would never, again, this isn't conscious. We would never say I'm envious. We just feel uncomfortable and we don't like it and she's making us feel bad. And so our instinct, when we see a woman who has something that we want or is doing something that we want, is to deprecate her and to say things like, I just don't like her. She rubs me the wrong way. She thinks she's all that. Who does she think she is? It's this why her and why not me, but we're so unaccustomed to understanding what's happening, right? Mm-hmm. And so this woman is pushing on a dream that we have for ourselves. And this is where the sins start Venn diagramming with each other. So pride and envy are very related. And so many women are terrified that if they're seen or celebrated in any way for achievements, that they'll inspire envy and be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And we have a big playbook of destroying women, typically visible ones. Tall poppy syndrome, I'm sure. I know all Australians know that well. And I know it cuts across genders in Australia, not as much in the US. And then there's also greed and this idea of scarcity and this toxic myth of scarcity, which is very real to women, but ultimately a myth, which is there's only room for one. If Sarah has a hit podcast, then that spot is taken. And so in order for me to have a hit podcast, I need to destroy Sarah. So it's this idea of I will dethrone her. She has a target on her back. Not like, oh, wow, there are 20 hit podcasts, many of whom which are helmed by men. Like, I'm just going to use what Sarah's doing as a model for what's possible and an invitation. And if she can do it, I can do it too. Instead, we see it as a competition and a threat. And this is not a natural thing. This is all culture. But that it just feeds our envy in this vicious cycle of destroying each other rather than using each other as examples of what it would look like to do what you want to.
Totally. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, when I reflect on my life and you think about like Darwinism and it's like every man for itself, that kind of idea. And I was always a bit like, if, you know, someone had that, then maybe I couldn't get it. Or it's just, you know, from when you're young, you just, that's the way that you're thinking and you don't even know why that is. And it's really when I got into personal development work that I realized, no, it's like the more the merrier. And if not, like if you believe in the law of reciprocity, the more goodness you put out, the more you receive, the more you help others on their journey, the more that you get helped. And there's the universe is abundant. And my whole mentality changed and I've never been so helped on my journey and had so much goodness come to my life because I'm putting out to help others, knowing that the scarcity thing in my mind was just a fabrication.
Yeah.
And this envy of others and not being able to achieve because someone else has, it's just, it's not true.
It's not true. And men are proving this on the daily if we pay attention. But, you know, even just thinking about the industry that we're in and in podcasts, it's so dominated, right? By sort of within the health and wellness space, primarily dominated by men. Many men who don't really interview women. That's a whole nother conversation, but it's pretty abysmal. But they sure interview each other. And so when you look at these guys who theoretically you would assume would be in competition with each other, that they'd be pursuing the same audiences and that they would, are they all, from what I know, they're on a WhatsApp chain together. They all, when they have a book or a project, they sort of run each other. They run, they all circle, do the circle and go on each other's podcasts. And, the response, they've only gained dominance. They've only gotten bigger through helping and supporting each other. And I was working on an op-ed about sort of what it means that these men never interview female MDs, female PhDs, even though women are out-earning men in degrees by a significant margin. I'm mad that women haven't gotten the memo that like we need to create corollary. We need a corollary. Mm. You know, we need to, who cares what they're doing? We need a similar movement and of mutual support in order to counter it. But it's this idea of scarcity that does not at all inhibit men. They don't feel it.
It's interesting. I've never actually thought about that before. But now you're saying it, I'm kind of reflecting and I'm like, that makes so much sense. But I still think, you know, some even how you and I met was so beautiful and so natural and the right people put us together. When we got connected, I thought, that's so nice of Elise. I really did think this. She's not looking at me as like a competitor of hers, you know, like,
no.
Because I yeah. still do know a lot of women that wouldn't go, I love your podcast. They'd just pretend they didn't even know about it, even if they did. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like an ego thing as well.
Oh, I know what you mean, Sarah.
She really like walks the walk and talks the talk, Elise. And, you know, our friend Sarah Harden is exactly the same. I mean, you know, her and Reese are yes. just doing amazing things with Hello Sunshine. But there needs to be more of that.
It's wild how unrestricted the men are in terms of their feeling that helping someone who has a very comparable show will in no way inhibit their own success. So it's just, it's like a cultural retraining. And yes, to sort of celebrate each other and look for opportunities to create reciprocity and be more overt about it, more conscious, more sort of like, I'm going to study. I want to know, do you have anything that you can share with me about, you know, just
yes.
actually leaning into it. Not that there needs to be sort of a supply and demand of information, but that it's not inherently guarded
yes.
out of fear of someone else's success.
I wonder, how has your life changed since knowing that and doing that?
About the scarcity?
Yeah.
As with everything in the book, it's not a book that's like, this will solve all your problems. But it's one of those books where the awareness of these scripts is so impactful in terms of being able to interrupt the program, interrupt what's happening in my mind. And so to recognize when I'm in the presence of that sort of restriction, either in myself or among other women, has been really powerful just to understand. So two things. One has been, I've done a fair number of circles with women, often women who know each other and have some overlapping of interest. And one of the things that we do is we write down something that we want, something that maybe we've been unable or ashamed to admit to ourselves, much less say it out loud or share it with other people. And you can feel, Sarah, in the room, the anxiety, the shame, the grief, and the fear of scarcity, honestly, that someone's going to hear what they want come out of another woman's mouth. And what's amazing about this exercise is that, one, the emotion as people read what they want, and then second, how beautiful what people want is. Not that it has to be, again, but, you know, you'll hear like, I want to write a children's book about spirituality. I want to host a podcast about palliative care. I want to start a regenerative farm. And that's the other thing. Even in this group of women, this one group I'm thinking of in particular, where they were doing group work together all year, there was no overlap. Things weren't even close to being in the same lane. There might be two desires for podcasts, but in completely different categories. And so you could just feel the scarcity dissolve for one. And this like, oh my God, I want that for you too. What would it look like if all of these women got what they wanted and brought that into the world? Is electrifying. And then I would say too, as I was bringing this book into the world, I was like, wow, I've done a lot for a lot of people who have significant platforms. And I realized how much transaction, unstated, so shadow, I would call it like a shadow vow or shadow expectation, covert longing I had that there'd be some reciprocity. And as I brought my book into the world, I decided like, I can't stay in the realm of longing and hoping, as you said, that people would say, oh, wow, you have a book coming out. Like, how can I help you? Particularly women. And I was interviewing an author, a man who I'd interviewed when I was at Goop. And he was asking me about my book, which was coming a few months after his. And I was like, how do you do this? Like how, you know, he had asked me overtly twice, right, for support. And he was like, you have to ask, you have to make it overt, you ask. And So I put that to myself, like as a test of this idea of scarcity, and I asked for support in a way that I would not have allowed myself to do a few years ago. I would have just hoped. I would have just longed. I would have, you know, just waited and then been really sad and disappointed. And guess what? Some people showed up for me. A lot of women showed up for me and men who I had no transactional relationship with at all whatsoever. And a lot of people didn't. And that's okay. I asked. I made it overt. And but it was scary because it's a test of relationships in a way that's not always the answer that you want, you know? But I'm so glad I asked. It was clarifying and a really, really powerful exercise of just, again, not leaving these things in the shadows, but just bringing them up. Make that want overt and make the ask. And yeah, it's not like a kumbaya story, but it was certainly interesting.
That is fascinating. I wonder how you made peace with yourself for those that maybe you thought would say yes and said no.
Well, I would say one of the things that I learned from another podcaster was when I'd emailed her and I had no relationship with her and her book was coming out a few months after mine. And she said, I will happily do a podcast swap with you and I would love to have you on. Will you have me on? And so we had there was a transaction there, right? There was an expectation of reciprocity. And in that moment, I realized like the failure of these women to show up for me, I didn't make the invitation to support them conditional. Again, it was so overt, right? So like they're pardoned. They didn't know they were in some sort of unspoken contract with me, right? So that's like the most graceful way I've been able to sit with it. But I know, I mean, I'm human. So I know. I don't know that it would change how I would respond to their future projects or anything, but I would like to think that I would, if I loved the work, it wouldn't bother me.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a little bit of a tough pill, I have to say.
But you know, you got to ask if you want to receive. So yeah, you got to ask. It's so important. I want to talk about another one of the sins that you speak about, which is gluttony. And you say culturally, we don't accept fat people. You know, when I read that, I thought, oh, that's quite shocking, you know, but it shouldn't be like that. What did you find in your research and why do we look at gluttony as still being such a like no-go zone and something that, you know, especially as a woman, I feel like I had this in my life where it's like I couldn't sit still. If I was just spending an hour watching TV, I just would feel so guilty about that. You know, I had to always get up and be doing stuff for my kids or for me, or I just, it's like a visceral feeling I have to this idea of gluttony.
Yes. And sloth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So gluttony, I mean, it's the most visible and in some ways the most oppressive of the sins. It's also the one that is baked into our legal systems. It's baked into our medical establishment, certainly. In the U.S., it's completely acceptable, except in maybe one or two states, to discriminate based on size.
Really?
Which is shocking, right? Considering how many other rights we try to affirm, although we're kind of failing these days. But it's completely acceptable to be fat phobic. And when you look at the research around implicit and stated biases, fat phobia is not only rampant, but it's in some ways venerated because that there's this insistence from the medical establishment and from the culture at large that a fat person lacks discipline, has no self-love, is a tax on the healthcare system. And if they just could control themselves, Sarah, if they just had more discipline, then they would certainly not look like that. And it just flies in the face of everything that people know about the science of obesity, which is they don't really know what's going on, only that there are dozens and dozens of genes that are involved and that it is far beyond personal responsibility. It is not a calories in, calories out equation. It is incredibly complicated and involves our entire culture and the environment, from our food supply to the toxins in our water and air to trauma to fat phobia itself, fueling the retention of weight. It's so complex. You know, I write about this one researcher who wrote a book called The Obesogen Effect. And this is what he does. He studies the impact of, you know, endocrine disrupting chemicals and whatnot. And he writes about the work of Mike Skinner, who's at the University of Washington, who found that, for example, this is just one chemical, that when they expose mice to DDT, which was rampant in the environment in the 50s and 60s, the first generation of mice have birth defects and the second generation have obesity. So this is a much bigger, much more complicated conversation. But yet we tend to tie it to the individual and make it about personal responsibility and personal choices in a way that is so fundamentally wrong. But it's so rampant because you'll meet very few doctors who don't talk about weight as a primary indicator of health, even though it's not fat that's the problem. It's where the fat is. Is it wrapped around your organs or is it subcutaneous? And if it's subcutaneous, which is what it is for many, many obese people, where it's really close to the skin, it has no impact on your health. So, and people go wild. And of course, obesity is correlated with increased heart disease and incidence of type 2 diabetes, et cetera. But it's not, the BMI is not a measure of health. It's not an accurate adjudication of what's happening in your body. That was a rant. Sorry.
No. It's so unbelievably fascinating. This book, this whole book is fascinating. And we can't touch on all the sins because we'll be here for hours because there's just so much to talk about. But I did want to talk about lust because I feel that one is a little bit, well, they're all completely different, but it's something that I feel like as women, that's still repressed a bit. Like, yes, there's all like, you know, so many beautiful women out there that are coming out and being so gorgeous with their sexuality, and we need more of that. And I think that's inspiring a lot of people, but still it's almost like this sin of this idea of lust and being sexy and what we desire as much as a male desires. There's no difference. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to take your perspective on that. And I mean, you also have a story in the book about your own youth and finding out about abuse that happened to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a double whammy for women. I write about the work of this woman, Deborah Tolman, who writes about how girls are taught to be desirable, but never desiring, right? Mm-hmm. To be chosen, but never choosing. Mm-hmm. And there's this idea in our culture, and I think we see this everywhere, of how ideal it is to be objectified by yourself and by other people, to be sexy, but not sexual. We're actually terrified of sexual girls and women. This would be, you know, girls, women who are in their bodies, who are determinant of their desire, who know what they want, who will ask for what they want, demand what they want, right? That's still abhorrent in our society. We do not like that. And as much as we like this sort of like willing receptacle, right? This woman who looks a certain way and seems inviting of sex, but not so desirous, so out of control with her own wanting. And then meanwhile, girls and women, and I don't know if it's as bad as it is in Australia, but we have a terrible record of believing women and, you know, a vast majority of cases of alleged sexual assault never make it to trial, much less to a verdict. It's pretty abysmal here in the US. But there's this insistence that girls are more responsible and that boys are just out of control and irresponsible and can't be trusted. And so girls are set up as the babysitters to rapacious male desire. It is your job to patrol your own body and to ensure your own safety. And if something happens to you, you are in some ways a co-conspirator. And the questions are, what were you wearing? Were you drinking? Why did you get in that Uber? And on and on and on, rather than an expectation that boys can also be responsible for patrolling themselves. So it's a really, it's so slippery and it's so sad, I think. And I do write about sort of my own experiences, which are very similar to the experiences of a majority of women and many men and boys. But when I think about how that has that's inhibited me throughout my life and created dissociation and a lack of not wanting to be in my body and not wanting to draw attention, that makes me very sad for me. And I think for all the women who can relate to that, because I recognize at a young age that that intensity of attention, that's very dangerous and that I'm somehow responsible for that.
How do you heal from that?
For me, it was MDMA therapy, which is how I even really understood what had happened to me, which mutes the amygdala. And so you don't have a fear response and you can work with the experience by being with yourself as a younger person and not reliving it as yourself, if that makes sense. So that was very helpful because it just lets, regardless of what you're contending with, it just lets all this unprocessed material come up. And I'd say just even the even observing yourself as a child is inherently incredibly powerful. It's like, for me, it was how I understood somatically what inner child work is, rather than but what it is to really hold yourself and be with yourself and to recognize. For me, it was very powerful to see myself as a child who's the same age as my son and say, oh, you are a child. Because I think when things happen to us as kids, we have this feeling of being, you know, big little adults and we're in control and we're responsible. And then you see yourself as an 8-year-old and you're like, oh, no, you are a tiny child. And so that was very powerful for me, more so than needing retribution or needing details or needing justice. It was for me more about, oh, this wasn't your fault. You didn't create this situation. You didn't want this situation. You didn't enjoy this situation, even though you might have wanted the attention.
That's so powerful. I wonder for you, Elise, what is the best advice that you have ever been given?
Wow, that's a big question. Here's something that I think about, and I didn't get this advice from a person, but I read it in a book, but I think about it all the time, both as the mother of boys and as a woman. And this is the work of Carol Gilligan, who wrote In a Different Voice, which is about the silencing of the voice of young girls and the development of morality and how girls come to see themselves as being in service to the world while boys come to see themselves as being in the world. And she writes about working or studying these young children, and she says that at a certain point, the word don't enters their vocabulary. And for boys, it's I don't care. And for girls, it's I don't know. And so I think about that probably every day, both in the context of my boys, and I write a chapter on sadness because that was on the original list of sins and then was kicked off. And I think that the dislocation from feeling is what's killing our boys and men and turning these wounded boys into wounding men culturally. But I think about that in the context of my sons and keeping them connected and tethered to their feelings and the fact that they do care very much, both about their own emotional lives and about other people. And then for myself, I keep reminding myself, oh, I do know. I know. And I have my body has an intelligence. We all have so many different sources of intelligence. And so I know, and it's okay to allow that knowing and to trust it.
What is something that you wish for yourself?
Ooh, spaciousness, stillness, you know, probably similar to you. It's my, when I get anxious and frenetic, then I start taking on a lot of, you know, consulting gigs and whatnot. And and then I'm suddenly in this situation. And it's funny, this woman I mentioned, Carissa, had said to me probably in 2019, if you don't make space in your life, the divine will make it for you. If you don't cancel things, we will cancel them for you. So you can choose, or we will do it. And I think about that all the time when I get overburdened with commitments. So what I want is space, stillness, spaciousness. And because that's, for me, that feels like freedom.
Do you have a favorite prayer or saying or mantra?
Well, I'd say my mantra is, I don't know. And then this is another thing that I think about too, as I think about what I want to create, which is another Chris is saying, your vibration must be higher than what you create. Otherwise, you cannot manage it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say it again so people can hear it. Your vibration must be higher than what you create. Otherwise, you cannot manage it. And for anyone who's building a business or creating an empire, think about that. Because so often, and I've seen this happen to so many friends in the health and wellness world and other environments, where they just start, it runs away from them. And suddenly they have a lot of mouths to feed and they have goals to hit and KPIs to meet. And they've just lost the plot. And so I just remember, be intentional about what sounds like a good idea, because you need to water that idea and tend that idea and harvest that idea and make sure you have the energy to do this so that you aren't flat out on your back with something that's out of your control, sort of the wrong word, but that's not what you intended.
What's been your most memorable mystical experience?
Oh, I've had a few. I have a migraine disorder and I really shouldn't drink alcohol anyway. And I still drink very rarely when it seems really worth it. But I was drinking more at this point. It was COVID and we were all, you know, I was doing what everyone else was doing, which was transitioning from coffee to wine. And I had a visitation in the middle of the night by Mother Mary. Everyone who's listening will think I'm insane, but hey.
I love it.
And she, I mean, it was real. It was like I was awake. I felt horrible, Sarah. I'd had a glass of wine. I felt like I was going to vomit. I felt terrible. And she said to me, you cannot drink. You are not allowed to drink. You cannot run energy and drink in this way. Promise me that you will... more or less, she didn't demand total abstinence, but she was like, tell me that you understand. And I was like, I understand. And then I felt infinitely better and went back to sleep. And I pretty much stopped drinking. Is that interesting?
Wow. Did you see her or did you just hear her?
It was like a felt presence. I've felt her before. I feel, and I call her Mother Mary, but she could be any mother. This is who I felt the presence of when I was a child. And I felt her a few times where she'll like in the middle of the night, I'll be aware of her presence and it feels like she's like playing with my hair. So yeah, it was sort of seen, but not more felt, more of a felt visitation.
Mm, beautiful. What is a life of greatness to you?
Oh, such a good question, Sarah. You know, we hear a lot about purpose and I just don't know that I buy the idea of a single purpose. I think a life of greatness is continuing and evolving contribution at the level to which you're equipped. And I think that that comes from having your me story that ladders up to this we story that's connected to the story in that great cosmic egg. And that in some way, your life, the contribution you're making is furthering our understanding of how we're all connected and all part of this really big story.
Elise Lunan, you are a wealth of knowledge. Your book, On Our Best Behaviour, is an absolute must read. You're such a beautiful writer. Thank you so much for the conversation today. It's been really beautiful.
Thank you, Sarah. Such a joy and pleasure, and I can't wait to see everything you bring into the world.
Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Your Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my manifestation course and meditations, head to the shop tab at saragrimberg.com or this week's episode show notes to find a link. If you love what you heard, we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. Listener.